Good morning, members. And I'll call this meeting to order. We have the agenda in front of you. We will have a meeting tonight, correct? So rather than adjourn this meeting, I'm going to go into recess. Just a moment. We will have public testimony both this morning and tonight. Anyone is interested in testifying? Representative Ferguson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't hear. Did you say we're going to recess, or is it a separate meeting this evening?
We'll recess.
And what is this evening's schedule?
Pardon?
What is the schedule for this evening?
This evening we will have the zoo, the conservation tour, and continue with Bowser.
In that order?
Yes.
So approximately what time would the Bowser presentation start?
I would imagine that the zoo will take a good half an hour, and probably the same for the Conservation Corps. But you're asking me to anticipate questions, and that's something I can't do. That's only a very, we haven't asked for long presentations, if that's your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just many of us have constituents that are driving in from all over the state for an evening event, and many of us feel that our constituents are important and that we should meet with them when they drive many hours to come to the Twin Cities to see us, especially early in the session when they have tried to accommodate our normal schedule. And we're making it very difficult for them to get what they want.
Well, Representative Torkelson, normally we come here to work as hard as possible and get the people's work done. I have suggested before, and I will welcome it again, if folks would like to come to this meeting. We are in the best room for seating, and people can join us. We can certainly introduce them, and they may like to comment on what Bowser is saying, because that is something that they might be interested in.
So, Madam Chair, do you have money in the budget then to reimburse them for what they've spent for their dinner tonight that has already been prearranged and scheduled?
It's a party you want to go to, Representative Torkelson. Let's not go there.
Madam Chair, it's not a party. It's an event that has been held year after year. It's important to people all over the state of Minnesota, and you are, in my mind, dissing these folks.
I'm not going to comment on that. We welcome, with any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I'd like to second what Representative Torkelson said. I think that these events are set up many months in advance, and I feel that we're not taking them seriously. So, thank you,
members, and for the audience. If there's audience listening, there are multiple events every night, and folks choose to go to them and socialize, or choose to be in this building. And this committee has come here to work, and that's what we're going to do right now. And welcome the folks from Bowser. And let's start with your presentation. Actually, continue with your presentation. And as I understand it, you are going to do the clean water part and then continue, Mr. Jaski, with the remainder of your testimony tonight. Is that correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair, John Jaski, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. We plan to have Ms. Brahman will present the clean water portion and some of the other funds. And we've completed our general fund presentation, the overview at least, at the last committee hearing. And so if there are questions that need to be answered either yet today or tonight, we'll be able to handle that at your decision.
Super. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Fabian's point, I'm curious, Madam Chair, has the committee looked at the schedule? I'm trying to understand. I know the policy committee has not met a couple times. You and I both have a conflict tonight with another committee scheduled to meet at the same time you're going to be chairing this committee. I'm wondering, have you evaluated how many members would be available during the policy committee, which has almost never met so far?
No, and I don't plan to.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think we should recognize that there might be other possibilities here. And then at the same point, I don't understand why some of this stuff is not moving through the policy committee then, because between the two committees, we have five scheduled committee meetings each week. In the last biennium, the area that we dealt with did not meet that many times, and we had nowhere near the number of scheduled evening meetings. And so I'm just trying to understand, what are we trying to accomplish here, and why do we want to not allow these folks to go to these meetings that have been previously scheduled? It seems like we have other opportunities to meet our needs here.
If I remember correctly, I don't want to get into a debate about this, Representative McNamara, but if I remember correctly, in our finance committee, we rushed through people and did not give them a chance to testify. And there were many instances of that, and it's my intention that we do not rush through so that the public cannot testify. So we are going to leave ample time for the public to engage with us, and that is my intention. Would you want to start with your testimony?
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Sarah Stroman, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And as you noted, Madam Chair, we are going to begin with the Clean Water Fund portion of our budget this morning. So we're going to be partway through our presentation from last week. And we did provide this morning a set of supplemental slides, which will be the ones we'll be focusing on here this morning for your reference. And obviously, we'll be happy to answer any questions about either the Clean Water Fund or the general fund portion of our budget. As I think the members of the committee are aware, the Clean Water Fund is one of four funds that was established by the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, was approved by voters in 2008. The implementation of the Clean Water Fund is a multi-agency effort that includes Bowser, the DNR, the MPCA, Department of Health, Department of Ag, Public Facilities Authority, and the Metropolitan Council. Bowser's work focuses primarily on non-point source pollution reduction programs, but I think it's important to remember the larger context that we work within. One of the things that the agencies have done to help point out the coordination and the way that these the way that the work of the agencies fit together is a report that was released last year. I believe this was provided to you in your packets last week. And what it is a performance summary report that tries to help connect the collective actions that the agencies are taking with the outcomes that are achieved on the ground. And so that report card walks through 18 different performance measures and provides a qualitative assessment of how well we're doing and what actions are being implemented.
Thank you. Is that included? Yes, that is included in our packet. It is, I think, useful for citizens to see how we're doing. It's not a particularly useful tool for appropriating lots and lots of money. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Jaschke and Ms. Stroman. Looking at these pie charts with the Clean Water Fund and the General Fund, one of the constitutional provisions is not to substitute for existing funds. And so prior to 2009, we didn't have any Clean Water Funds. What was the General Fund budget in comparison to the amount we have now in General Fund back in 2009?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, in the materials that we presented last week, we had some actual numbers of the prior biennial appropriations in the general fund for the two biennials prior to the one under consideration now. So if you want to refer to those documents, that may be a starting point if you want to look at a more detailed version of the appropriations in the general fund, at a program or sub-program level. We can certainly prepare that for you and get it to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Mr. Deschke, I'm just worried we go the last two bienniums, but we look prior to that. I don't want to have us get into difficulty with litigation about the substitution if we are shifting over lots of dollars. It used to be general fund into clean water money.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, we've been taking extra special care not to make something like that happen. We have set up every single one of our clean water funds as a separate program. Ms. Truman will talk about this. The approach of the clean water fund was to be programmatic, but also not to be, as you described, substituting for something that was already taking place. And so we've been very careful about that, and we can at some point provide more detail on that if you're looking for that, or if you have a specific question, we can try and answer that today.
Okay, I'll continue, Madam Chair. As you can see from the pie chart on the left here, the governor's budget recommendation does include $67.97 million of clean water fund for Bowser. I think it's important to note, too, that the vast majority of this money does pass through the agency and goes out to local governments and their partners for on-the-ground programs and projects. If you look at the chart on the right, it shows the breakdown between the three programmatic categories for which we use clean water funds, the largest being clean water projects and practices that are done through competitive grant programs. Next is the permanent conservation easements, followed by the results, measurement, and evaluation. We do just want to point out the distribution from the 10-11 biennium and the 12-13 biennium of the local governmental units that have received funding through our competitive grant or easement program and the location of the projects that we've funded to date. Although I will point out that the 13 projects are not included, while those grants have been awarded, the projects are not yet underway. So as I mentioned, the competitive grant program is the largest clean water fund programmatic category for Bowser. This shows the 12-13 appropriations for each of the four grant programs within this area. The governor's recommendation is in the middle column, and then the Clean Water Council recommendation there on the far right. All of these grant programs go to local units of government that are working under a state-approved and locally adopted local water management plan or implementing an approved TMDL. Also want to point out that all of the grants leverage a minimum of 25% of the total project cost from non-state sources. And, of course, all the grant recipients are...
Excuse me, a question on that. When you say... when we talk about leverage and non-state sources, it's important to distinguish between other tax funds and funds that are not tax funds. So it would be helpful as we go forward to know if we're leveraging non-tax funds or if we're just asking local units of government funds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We could certainly provide a breakdown of the types of match funds that are provided through the grants. So for all of these programs, the grant recipients are required to report on the activities, the outcomes, and accomplishment of the grants. And then Bowser provides all of the oversight to ensure contractual compliance in accordance with the board and Office of Grant Management policies. The other thing that I want to point out, and we'll have a slide later on that shows this, is that the demand for these dollars far exceeds the amount of dollars that we have available to grant out. So I'll walk through each one of these briefly, and then we're going to show some examples of some of the projects and outcomes that have been achieved with this funding. So the first grant category is the Surface and Drinking Water Protection and Restoration Grants. This has been recommended at an amount of $36 million. These funds are used to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in our lakes, rivers, and streams, and the dollars fund both vegetative and structural practices that improve water quality by reducing runoff and retaining water on the land. They also fund feedlot projects and SSTS abatement grants. The second category is
that we're going to have another question. We're going to take questions as we go. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Stroman, if we could get a detailed breakdown of where those went, how many went to feedlots, how many went to cost share, how many went to, and you've got the map of the locations. Is it? Are you able to break those down by type?
We are, Madam Chair, Representative Hanson. We could certainly provide that. I don't believe we have that breakdown with us today, but it is available.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think if we're talking about $36 million, we need a little more detail.
The targeted local resource protection and enhancement grants fund projects and activities such as targeting tools, tools that help local governments target conservation practices, ordinances, or other kinds of organizational capacity that exceed state standards. So these would be for things that, for example, shoreline regulations are above and beyond what they're required to do anyway. The Conservation Drainage Management and Assistant Grants provide funding to local government units to install conservation practices on drainage systems to improve water quality. And finally, the Community Partners Clean Water Program is like a small grant program by which the Board of Water and Soil Resources provides grants to local units of government who then re-grant them to community organizations such as lake associations, conservation organizations, or other nonprofits to do clean water projects. And so it helps engage other members of the community in these types of projects.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Stroman, on the conservation drainage, is there any evaluation component on that where the water that comes out of the conservation drainage is measured for nitrates or phosphorus or any other potential contaminants?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, with all of these grants, and I'm going to get to that here, I think, on the next slide. Let me just flip here. So these are the outcomes. There are some of the outcomes from our conservation drainage grants. For all of these grants, the project proposers, as part of their reporting, are required to use pollution reduction estimators to estimate the amount of reduction in pollutants that will be achieved by these projects. So we do that on the front end of the project and then on the back end of the project as well. So what this chart shows is by year 2010, 2011, and 2012, the number of BMPs that were completed and then the total reductions of phosphorus, nitrogen, and sediment here. Later on, we have some specific examples, and there is a conservation drainage example, too, that shows how much was reduced according to the target for that project.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned estimators, so is it actual samples that are run through a lab, or is it modeling based on prior data?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, they are models.
Representative Bulk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was going to be my question as well, if they were using actual empirical data or just an estimate.
Let me follow up on that. So we estimate that we've reduced phosphorus by this much in a watershed, but without a context, well, is that 1% of the phosphorus? Is it 80% of the phosphorus? Without that kind of number, we don't really know what we're buying for our money, I don't think. Help me out here.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to get to some examples here in a moment. What is difficult is to provide the context on a statewide scale. So this is a roll-up of all of the conservation drainage grants that we provided. What we're going to walk through next is some examples of specific projects and the targets that are provided in those local water plans, and then you will see that context, the context that's provided by the local water plan, and then how much we are able to achieve through an individual project.
So let's back up to the surface water and drinking water board, which is the great amount of money. If we continue on this pace, I mean, we're about 20% through the money that we're going to get. If we continue on this pace doing what we're doing right now, in 20 more years, or when the money is gone, or when this is finished, will Minnesotans be able to say, yes, that worked, this body of water is cleaner, that body of water is cleaner, and it supports fish, and my fishing is better? Can we tell Minnesotans that?
Madam Chair, maybe it would help if I walked ahead here to some of these examples, because I think what...
No, I understand the example, but give me in the aggregate. I mean, I think we have to understand the aggregate, too. Or if you want to give the example, go ahead, and then come back to the aggregate so we can answer the question that Minnesotans are asking us.
Madam Chair, you know, you're asking a very big question. The answer, in my mind, is that some places we will be able to say yes, and some places we'll have to say we're not there yet, to be honest. I mean, and remember that there's three tools that we use to improve our water quality in terms of actual, you know, either protection or restoration. It's some form of convincing or persuasion or education to get people to take on different ways of managing your land so the water either gets cleaner or stays as clean as it is. Some portion of it is through controls on the land use controls that stop things that would otherwise be harmful from happening. And then the third way is to provide some financial incentives to make that happen. And so, you know, all of those things are not contained within the Clean Water Fund per se. And we are targeting at the places that are the most cost effective and have the most likely chance of success. But in 20 years, will all waters be meeting some water quality standard? I can nearly guarantee that the answer would be no. But we will have made a major step forward, and some places will be noticeably cleaner. That's a fact.
I think the expectations of Minnesotans are higher, and we have to figure out how we're going to meet those expectations. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is for you. Are you implying that we should only do projects where we know exactly what the outcome is, and can you explain to me how that's possible in the real world?
I don't know. I am just beginning to ask questions here to see if we can spend our money more effectively, and secondly, to see if in the end we will be able to show Minnesotans that we've done the best we can with their money and that they've got clean water. That's what they expect. So I don't think questioning my intentions right now is the appropriate thing to do. Let's understand as much as we can about how this money is being spent and whether we can spend it any better. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assure you that we've been working on this issue for years, and the water of Minnesota will get cleaner. But how you define clean would define what your answer is, and I don't understand what you're asking for.
Well, Representative Torkelson, we have TMDLs for one, and even if TMDLs are done and met and meet the clean water and we reduce the pollutants that we recognized in the 1970s, which is what we're working on now, there are additional things that are coming into our waters that may make it so our
We do not have good biology in our watersheds, and I think I sent around. Did we send this around? We sent you an editorial from the Star Tribune earlier this week, and I think that helps define additional issues that we have not addressed with the processes we're using. That is one good example. I hope you had an opportunity to read that.
Madam Chair, you seems like you're trying to apply very exact science to a system that has many, many variables, including the weather and tons of other variables. And, you know, these folks are doing great work all across the state of Minnesota to make our waters cleaner. And to somehow imply that because we don't all of a sudden have what you define as clean water, that these projects are unsuccessful is you're just unfair. It's unmeasurable.
The TMDLs are describing what clean water would be. That's number one. I am not describing. Number two, they don't address some of the pollutants that we are having to deal with. One of them would be triclosan, which was in the editorial and a study that just came out. And if you haven't had a chance to read the study, we'll make sure you get it. And in fact, I'll just make sure everybody in the committee gets a copy of the links to that study. We'll work on that. Let's continue.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make one mention. You know, there'll be some questions about, you know, what the way that we've chosen to present the data. We can do it, you know, on a project basis. We can do it on a watershed basis. We can do it on a statewide basis. We can do it on a monetary basis, we can do it on a pollutant reduction basis. And so if you're looking for something that's different than what we present here, we can certainly go back and put it in that form. I'm also going to ask the pages to hand out, because we have a whole lot of projects that by themselves aren't going to solve the whole problem, but cumulatively over time, that's what the approach is. Many small things done over many places will make a big difference. And so I'll just have the page pass these around, one in each direction. You can look at this at your leisure. We also have lots of this information as both required by law and as we've gone above and beyond to communicate these projects and the results of those to the public, anybody else that wants to see what they are.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn has a question.
Well, I actually just wanted to point out that the pollution is not just a Minnesota issue. It's also an international issue. And one of the benefits of coming late is I got to listen to NPR talking about the pollution of like Winnipeg. And the fact is that our discharge things is only into lakes. And the answer is this is a lake across an international boundary. And it's apparently protected by a treaty of 1909. So we have other worries besides just Minnesota lakes. And three of the major phosphorus, this is looking at phosphorus polluters, are three American crystal sugar plants. So just a bit of information.
Perhaps we'll get a link. We will do the link to that story, too, so members get a chance to see that. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Kahn's point on the Red River and Lake Winnipeg and Winnipeg, I serve on the steering committee for the International Legislators Forum. We sent a little thing around to all of the representatives. We do have another series of meetings coming up next June in Winnipeg. I would encourage you to come to Winnipeg and see what's going on. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Mr. Jaski said, we've chosen to illustrate the outcomes of these grant programs through a number of examples. And the first example we want to highlight is the Pullman Lake Restoration Project. This is an area in the city of Maplewood in Ramsey County. There is a TMDL for Pullman Lake that identified an impairment for phosphorus, with the main culprit being the high amount of impervious surface within the area. And so the Ramsey-Washington Metro Watershed District undertook a project with Clean Water Funds to retrofit the parking lot at the Maplewood Mall with a number of practices that would help keep water and infiltrate water there and treat water there. As you can see then from this example, the TMDL identified a needed phosphorus reduction of 209 pounds per year. This particular project reduced the phosphorus by 61 pounds per year, so we're able to meet 30% of that TMDL goal with this one project.
Can you tell us where the phosphorus was coming from? Tell us a little more about the project.
Madam Chair, I don't know if Mr. Jasky can provide more details. I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of the project. We certainly could provide you more details on any of these examples. So,
Mr. Jasky?
Madam Chair, yeah, I don't have the specifics with me because it's, you know, the TMDL is, you know, probably a 150-page report, but this area is fully developed. It's all urban or suburban landscape. There's a lot of you know, shopping malls, automotive dealers, and things like that are sort of in the area. And so largely it's urban runoff. Exactly what the sources are, I would have to go back and look. Actually, there is a component of the phosphorus problem that actually resides in the lake itself that it recycles from within. And of course, that can be ameliorated over time, but you can't deal with that via runoff. So that's the recall that I have on that, but we'll get you the details of that breakdown.
Just two follow-ups here then. Did you limit the phosphorus by having the water go through a wetland or something like that? Was that the solution?
Madam Chair, this project, as I said, you know, if we've got a water quality problem and the landscape is fully developed, we have to find ways to do water treatment within that landscape. And so this is a fairly unique project for a couple of reasons. One, we are the mall owner. This is private land now, right? All that's what we have to work with. There is no public land anymore to help fix this problem, at least not this part of the problem. They had to give up some of their parking area, obviously, to build a treatment system that would treat both the runoff that's coming off of their lot, and then it treats it in a subsurface system. And then, as I understand it, it does drain into an area before it gets to the lake. I have to go back and look at the exact design. But one of the key aspects of this was less about the design and the importance of making sure this is a durable practice. I mean, because a future mall owner's motivation would not be to have water quality treatment necessarily, although this owner did want that. And so we had to work with the mall owner and actually put a legal instrument in place to make sure that this project, the investment that we're making here, is going to be there for the life that it is expected to have to do this treatment. In this case, I believe it was 25 years. So this project will function and accomplish this benefit with this legal protection in place the entire time that this mall is here. Or if the mall is in some way removed, they will be obligated to replace this exact level of treatment in another fashion. So a lot of complexities. I'll have to get you the details of the design because I don't have those with me.
I think that's enough to be helpful there. What was the portion of the taxpayer of the legacy dollars versus the portion of the dollars provided by the mall owners?
You know, Madam Chair, I'm going to have to go back and look that up. In this case, there was a partnership that included a local project sponsor, the local watershed district, the Ramsey Metro Washington Watershed District. They have their own tax dollars that come in with through their levy, so they had a contribution. The private property had a contribution. I have to look that up to see what form it took. And we'll get you a breakdown of the dollars that went into it.
That would be helpful. Any other questions from members? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go back to an issue you brought up, and it's one that Representative Torkelson and I talked about one of the first days of session. Trickless sand. Are we going to have some hearings about that? And I'm trying to understand. My understanding, the little bit I've looked at it, it seems like the science might not support that chemical being used. Are we going to have any kind of a hearing about that?
I have not heard of any bill yet that anybody has had or any proposals yet. Would you like to have a hearing on it? I'd be glad to do it.
Ma'am, that's up to you. Madam Chair, that's up to you, but it just seems like an emerging issue that I kind of go back to the BPA one that we did a few years ago. It seems like something I'm trying to understand the chemical, and as you said, seems like only a few weeks after Representative Torkelson and I talked about it. It was in the article in the Minneapolis paper. So I would hope it's one of those issues that we, either in Representative Dale's committee or your committee, would look at it. Thank you.
Well, I think when PCA comes before us, we will ask about their TMDL. I think we can do that together because the triclosan was found in Lake Pepin, and the as I understand it, so were the contaminants that came from that. So that might be a good place to start our conversation. So we can do that. Professor at the U that did this study is Dr. Arnold, and he was funded by LC Cinemar money in part. So that would be another good reason to hear it. And I believe, I don't know whether LC Cinemar also funded the Science Museum, that was also one of the folks that did it. So that what the Star Tribune, I think, called this landmark legislation. I mean, landmark research. And because of that status, I think you may be well right, and we should hear it. Representative Dill, did you want to follow up on that?
Thank you, Chair Wagenius. Well, as Representative Wagenius said, there has been no bills yet on anything to do with frac sand mining, to my knowledge. If there are, and any chemicals that are used, those will be referred to policy first. And if they don't have any financial implication for the state, they'll go to the next proper committee.
To that point, Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I know I was mumbling, but I was actually asking about triclosan, the chemical.
Okay.
Though I do look forward to the discussion very much about frac sand.
I'm just going to be meeting today for a few minutes with the first group of frac sand mining people. And again, no bills have been introduced, and I don't intend to do anything till I see a bill. Paper keeps calling and saying, you know, what are you guys going to do? Well, I mean, I'm not going to have a hearing on something just for our health unless someone's really passionate about changing it or making an amendment to how we handle those types of things. I'm frankly, on the frac sand issue, I'm more apt to have it as a local control issue.
Back to the triclosan issue, just to follow up with your representative, McNamara, there are financial implications because one of the things, and I have asked this question, I don't know the answer to it yet, but you can remember when we did the funding to test above and below wastewater treatment systems to see what was coming out and what wasn't coming out. I am almost sure triclosan was one of those things that was tested. So the financial implication is in part for our wastewater treatment systems and in part for whatever we may need to do to clean up. So there are financial implications, but no bill. I have a list of folks. Representative Hansen, did you have a question now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think your line of questioning exposed the issue with the Coleman Lake one, is that the watershed districts have the taxing authority, so local property taxpayers pay this, pay a portion of this in addition. And there are areas, back to our prior discussion, where there are not watershed districts, then the general taxpayers, the state, pick up that cost of the cost share. I think the other thing that's unique with, or not that unique in the metro area proposals, is that what you have to do to maintain the practice by working with the landowner to ensure that that's maintained that landowner is not getting a property tax deduction for that installation of a conservation practice. They're having that cost that's accrued by them as part of the cost share, but they have no other deferment or benefit. Is that correct?
Manager Representative Hansen, As Ms. Roman mentioned, there is a match requirement, a minimum match for every project, and we'll get you the breakdown of the sources of the match. And one of those sources, of course, is the local levy dollars that a watershed district, if they're the project sponsor, has available. But there are other options as well. So, you know, I don't have that at my fingertips, but we'll get you that information. In the case of the Coleman Lake example, yes, the watershed district was the project sponsor, and yes, they did use some of their local levy dollars to contribute to the project.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask Representative Kahn if she has any facts or NPR has any facts to back up that suggestion that American Crystal may have phosphorus going into the Red River.
Nothing except what I heard, that there are phosphorus that also problems of the sewage waste control from sewage systems in it, and all sorts of things. I'm sure that the information is available.
We will make sure that comes to you so you can hear it, and if you would, you know, we can also get something to follow up from other folks on that. We'd be glad to do that.
Madam Chair. So then it may not necessarily be a company. It could be other factors.
No, I think they have, Madam Chairman, I think they have, there are many other factors, yes, that was just listed as that there are three plants, the three of the biggest producers of phosphorus. You know, that this, and with the whole problem is of sewage plants, is that phosphorus is one of the largest components of human sewage. So it's a whole issue, but the point is that it became it's now an international issue with this complaint about the pollution going into Lake Winnipeg, and then the other thing which was of interest to me is that we only seem to care about pollution going into lakes, not rivers and things that feed into lakes. So that's why, even though it's going into the Red River, it's the law specifically only relates to the lake. And then the issue is it just relate to lakes in Minnesota, or does it relate to other lakes? And it goes back then to this treaty of 1909, the Boundary Waters Pollution Treaty, whatever.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I would also suggest that if we're going to have facts, we should maybe have the facts from the company and what they do to protect the water that they use also, and do some very effective recycling. So, a suggestion.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I did read the article that you sent out on the triclofan. And I guess people can take out of articles what they're pre-existing, what they feel, but as I recall, they weren't exactly sure what the interactions were, and one line said there may be toxins produced that are dangerous to humans. So we don't know for sure what exactly these interactions are. So, you know, if we're going to go ahead and pass legislation or whatever on this particular thing without knowing really its full impact, that's kind of the cart before the horse, isn't it?
Well, Representative Anderson, there's no legislation proposed. I think that my offer was to hear from the scientists who actually did it, and we'll also get the science papers sent around to everybody. So I don't know of any legislation. I haven't heard of any proposed, but I think just because of the cost implications for us, Representative McNamara is probably right, and we should hear it. Representative Baker.
I'll pass. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Torkelson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, if we're going to look at the phosphorus issue in the Red River Valley, I would encourage us to also consider what's happening across the state border in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that we are going to look at this specifically and take this on as an issue. I think it's an issue for our pollution control agency. So when they come here on, they're scheduled for next Thursday and the Tuesday after that. I think these are questions for them, not questions for me. I certainly have run the Pollution Control Agency. Representative Fabian, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I would also then encourage us to see if we can't get data from Manitoba as well, because the Red River obviously runs through Manitoba to get to Lake Winnipeg. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll continue with the next example, which is from Benton County. Again, another TMDL-related project. This one's related to Little Rock Lake, which is a lake of high recreational value in Benton County, but suffers from blue-green algae blooms and a phosphorus problem. You can see here the TMDL reduction goal of 10,585 pounds. And with this project funded through the Clean Water Grant, the SWCD was able to do, there were actually a couple of projects, but a number of practices to help reduce the phosphorus coming from agricultural sources. So activities like animal feed management strategies, buffer strips, and pasture fencing to be able to reduce the phosphorus going into the lake. And you can see there how much we're progress towards the goal. Switching gears a little bit, wanted to show an example of one of the targeted resource and protection grants. This is in the Red River Basin, and funding here was able to help develop tools to prioritize conservation actions and help identify where conservation actions would have the most benefit. So the top picture here shows the stacked hydrograph information. So this is helping to identify areas for water storage to reduce the frequency of high flow events. And then the bottom picture there is the stream power index tool to help target where practices can be placed to reduce gully and field erosion. And the final example we want to highlight is Fish Lake. This is a protection project in Jackson County. Fish Lake is kind of a unique lake there. In addition to being the headwaters of the Wantanwan River, it's quite a deep lake and supports a healthy fishery, including some game species. And the goal here was to keep the water quality good in this lake. And so a number of projects were installed to reduce gully erosion, number one. So the top photo here, you can see what was happening with the erosion along this gully down to the lake to restore that. And then the other part of this project was to install bioreactors at the tile outlet. So this is an example of some of those conservation drainage practices to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment. And so you can see what the estimated reductions are here. The chart in the blue just shows the fisheries data, and so it's able to show then the quality of the lake in terms of the fish that it's able to support.
So help us a little bit more with, Representative Hansen first, maybe I'll answer. That's my question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Stroman. So the Fish Lake project was funded with clean water money?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes.
And could that project have been funded with outdoor heritage money that would be designed to protect fish habitat under the constitutional language?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think probably it may have also qualified as a habitat project if that was the main goal, was the fish habitat. I think here there were probably some broader water quality goals as well.
Madam Chair. And so, Ms. Stroman, so this project came through the competitive grant process through the Clean Water Fund. Was it a small grant, or was it just came up through the Soil and Water District to Bowser and had clean water money provided?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, my understanding is that this, yes, came through the competitive grants process as a conservation drainage project.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Stroman or Mr. Jashke, could projects like this be submitted to the DNR Conservation Partners grants for fish habitat, outdoor heritage?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, you know, I suppose they could be. How successful they would be, I guess, is to be determined. You know, clearly high-quality aquatic habitat is dependent on high-quality water. I mean, there's no question about that. Because this, as Ms. Stroman mentioned, has a lake with fish in it, obviously, it also has other recreational uses. And so there's that area that sometimes not explicitly one way or the other in terms of the constitutional funding, I suppose. Maybe you've identified an example here.
Have you finished talking about this?
No. Yes, Madam Chair.
Tell us why was this particular lake, we have 10,000 lakes, why was this particular lake chosen? And I noticed along the shoreline here that it is sand and not fish habitat. Is that one of the issues there, that we don't have shoreline rules? Is that one of the things that keeping the lake from not being healthy is fish habitat? So those are two questions.
Madam Chair, I'll give you the best information I have, which isn't anything specific anymore about this lake. I once upon a time worked on in that part of the state and remember this lake, but not anything about this project. The reason it was chosen, and remember, this project it's not at the point where the water quality has gone below the standard, right? We're trying to protect it from getting bad, right? So we have, you know, hundreds of these projects, so we can bring you all 100 or 200 or 500, but we're trying to find some examples. This is an example of protection because this lake was picked as a priority water resource by the local officials, by their county water plan. And they said, of all the problems we got and things we want to do to protect our waters, this one is at the very top because this lake is so important because it's got, you know, a high-quality fishery for that area and it's got recreational use. So they decided that, and, you know, we support that. The second point about this particular site and the shoreline utilization there, I can't speak to the zoning issues. These structures look like they've been there for quite some time, so I'm expecting that they weren't recently constructed. Most of the lakes in that part of the state are in the general development category for shoreline zoning, and you can ask the DNR more about that. But that has a smaller setback for buildings and things like that. So I don't know what the rest of the shoreline looks like on this lake. Obviously, this is just about a 50-foot little area, but there has to be some quality fish habitat and spawning areas in there, otherwise these game species you see here in this chart wouldn't be able to survive and thrive.
Representative Hamilton, then Vivian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to this lake, my family and I, we spent hours on this. It is a recreational lake. It's a nice lake for the area, no question about it. And there's a gentleman by the name of Tony Thompson who is a takes water quality in these projects very, very seriously. His family owns farm ground around there, and he is, I would say that he's instrumental in pushing projects like this forward, not only on this lake, but like Huron Lake as well down there. And so, like I said, there's some very environmentally conscious people down there that were looking for projects in the area, and so I would say Tony Thompson and other in the area was pushing for this project pretty hard. This is a nice lake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment on the fish habitat. Sand is an important component to fish habitat. Director Jaski talked about spawning areas and so forth. I know that's where walleyes do spawn, is in sand and gravel and so forth. So I'm not respectfully ask your comment about it being sand but not fish habitat. I'm wondering what you meant by that. Thank you.
I think one of the issues that we have to wrestle with is shoreline rules and the desire of some to protect shoreline for fish habitat, and it's probably not sand they're talking about. So it's, if I misspoke from your point of view, I'm sorry. But I think that what I was trying to bring up is this whole issue of we're having, in this case, it's protection, and that was good to hear that this is forestalling a problem, and a lot of times we are restoring because we didn't do the forestalling. And that's where the shoreline rules come in.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Jasky, I'm just curious. The photo to me actually doesn't show some of the things you talk about. You talk about bioreactor in water control structure. It does show a culvert coming out. Unfortunately, it has no silt fence or bio roll or anything below it, and it shows the topsoil being restored and not protected. It's really not a good photo to show what the language talks about. I'm wondering if you could just give us a little more information about this specifically. For instance, this instance, did we ask the, and truthfully, the riprap is kind of embarrassing to see that put in today. I hope this is an old photo, that we're not really still doing that with the different things. And I'm just curious, I realize it's on private property and the above photo is embarrassing for the people that live there that they let it happen. Can you get us a little more information, background on this, and is this current practices today to do this? And if you happen to have a photo of where the actual bioreactor is, I'm curious. In the top photo, I see a car. There evidently is some parking up above. I'm just curious to know a little bit more about this. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, we'll get to that. For all three of these projects, we can get you, you know, the details of both the design and the, you know, the cost. My recollection of this lake isn't as good as Representative Hamilton's, but this gully that's formed here is bringing water that's coming from a distance beyond these two property owners, as you can imagine. And so it's a multi-landowner problem, and the solution is going to take the same. The bioreactor, the picture of one is very difficult to get. Of course, it's underground and invisible, except at the time you're installing it, but it's basically an underground reservoir with wood chips typically as the medium to do the treatment and store some water and treat it at the same time. So we'll get you the design on this. And I would agree with you in the sense that this shoreland protection mechanism here, we have better options these days, or at least more options. Sometimes rock is the only thing that we can use because of the space available or the wave action, things like that. But you're right, there are a lot more, as we call them, bio-based approaches to shoreland protection that we have now that we once upon a time did not have.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Director Jasky, you're right on, and I hope the photo's old. I hope this isn't something that we did in the last year or two. There certainly is a lot of, I mean, if I was to see that picture, I actually would be showing that as really bad practice. There's no protection. The regrading is really poor. I don't know if they tried to hold the water between those homes back somewhere, back behind it, and how they've done with that. There's no restoration of the habitat on that shoreline, and I don't know. Those two homeowners got some benefit of that being fixed, and I don't know if they paid for it or if they were educated as to what would be the right thing to do or a better. It's better than the photo above that. I agree with that, but you're led to believe that all we did is pipe the water down, and it, as you said, there's a bioreactor above, and hopefully there's some rainwater garden incorporated into that, and if we're bringing water from a big area, it'd be interesting to see what we are doing, but as we bring these things forward, I would hope that we would show really our best management practices today and not this. Thank you.
It brings up a really good question about this is not keeping water on the land, it is helping drain. And the suggestion that Representative McNamara made about rain gardens and holding the water back to seep in does seem to be the current best management practice. Am I right about that, Representative McNamara?
Yes.
You want to continue?
Yes, Madam Chair, we'll continue. We'll move on here to the conservation easement programs that are funded through the Clean Water Fund. We have two of them, the riparian buffer program and the wellhead protection program. I'll just briefly say that the wellhead protection program focuses on drinking water supply areas that have been designated as having high or very high vulnerability. So this allows us to acquire permanent conservation easements to protect land from uses that could potentially contaminate those groundwater sources within those drinking water supply areas. The riparian buffer program focuses on acquiring easements along public waterways, excluding wetlands, and we want to describe that program in a little bit more detail, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Jasky to talk a little bit more about that program.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Hansen asked a question about, you know, the connection sometimes that some of these projects could have with the Ultra Heritage Fund versus the Clean Water Fund. There is one program, and this is the one where we have funding that comes from two separate constitutional funds, in this case the Clean Water Fund and the Outdoor Heritage Fund. We built this program to use the initial 50 to 100 feet of buffer area. These are permanent easements that is paid for by the Clean Water Fund, and then where in circumstances it makes, we can add a wider buffer for habitat reasons to make a corridor between habitat nodes, then that option also exists as well. So we end up with two constitutional funds all into one easement along a very sometimes, you know, specific weaving area along a riparian watercourse or stream. And so I wanted to just point that out. We've also used some bonding money because the demand for this program has been very, very high, and the need, of course, is also high, and I'll show you a little bit more details about what that need might look like. Madam Chair, you asked us to give a little bit more of a deep dive into this one area, so I'm going to present the analysis that we've done in terms of understanding how much of a need is out there and the benefits of riparian buffers from a water quality perspective, principally, because we're talking about the Clean Water Fund component here. Here are two separate maps, one on the on your left from Otter Tail County and one on the right from Manoman County. Looking at these water courses, or in the case of Manoman County, it also shows some water bodies that have areas where water moves through the landscape. In the case of the Otter Tail County example, you can see that there are some areas, and these are, you know, our best estimates using remote or desktop methods. The green areas are shown to have a buffer area, and the red areas, you know, are indicating an area that does not have a buffer area next to what would otherwise be some cultivated land use. The Manoma County example also shows, you know, we've got some, you know, in the case of the Otter Tail example, we have a very obviously identifiable water course there, a very large public water river system moving through. But we also have many, many thousands of miles of these intermittent streams, if you want to think of them that way, where water moves off the landscape intermittently. We don't have a river, we don't have a ditch, we have a swale, we have a small water course that has water in it ephemerally. So, you know, depending on how you count which things might be benefiting from a buffer, these numbers are going to vary dramatically. So I just want to put that in your mind, that obviously everyone thinks of a water course, you know, but we also have water moving across the landscape in very small landscape features. So we had one of our staff, we challenged him, and he was, you know, wanting to make sure that we pass on the limitations of doing these assessments using existing GIS database. You're looking at trying to discern whether a buffer area exists of, you know, 50 feet in width, let's say, on a landscape that has, you know, photography and the ability to interpret it, maybe not much more than that scale, plus or minus 50. So there are some limitations, but you know, we can, that's our best ability to analyze this statewide without having to actually send somebody in the ground and do all the ground truthing that it would take to make these estimates. And so this is his description of the method. I won't go into all of that. Obviously, we can get you more details about how this person carried out this analysis that we asked him to do. I'm just getting the conclusions here. I mean, and so there are a couple of different ways to think about this. There's all surface waters, which includes all of the intermittent things as well as the you know, the permanent streams and ditches. We also have, and I'll show you in a moment, you know, a subset that are identified as public waters, which have their own circumstances regarding permitting and regarding, to some extent, the shoreland zoning conditions. So we put a few pictures in here, and you know, we could have again thousands of pictures of things that are good or okay or not so good. And here's a couple of examples, just so you understand, because there are, you know, some requirements about buffers. The top photo shows a very well-functioning, you know, ditch system, very trapezoidal ditch system that's been either recently maintained or hasn't needed maintenance, with sloped side slopes that are grassed and, you know, the channel going down the middle. You can see that on the side that the photo's taken on, there is not a a buffer adjacent to that bank. It's not required here. This is a public ditch system that has either not had an improvement, which is very uncommon, or which is now becoming a little more common, a redetermination of benefits to require that 16 and a half foot or one rod width. So, and it may not necessarily provide a great deal of benefit here. We don't know. I don't want to make any presumptions. There very well could be a tile intake that was further away from the ditch where they had a buffer around the intake. So every one of these things is site specific about which practice and which design we need to make fit the site. The lower photo does show a buffer along the one side. You can see that on the, it'd be on the left side, I don't know which direction that would be. They're doing some maintenance work to re-slope that ditch system. You know, these are a very common feature of how the landscape out in our agricultural areas looks, that we have very well-developed buffers here. This one doesn't happen to have any terrific habitat benefit, but certainly provides a clean water function. The other thing that we do is when we put these buffers in place is make every effort to get a high quality native plant community, because although, you know, sort of any plant with a decent root system will do some water quality benefit, in order to make sure that they're going to be there for a long time and provide some ancillary benefits such as habitat, we want to make sure those native plant communities are strong. So the graph on your right, or the chart, this is the initial attempt to look at all surface waters in the state of Minnesota in the areas of the state, the 67 counties that have cultivation of their lands of greater than 30%, just to make the data set a little bit more manageable. And so you see that with this rough estimate, you know, there's a little over 1 million acres of land that would be included in that 50-foot riparian area adjacent to all of our waters. And if we just broke that down and just looked at the perennial waters, not the ones that are intermittent, that number gets to about half. And then, and that's the blue bars you see. And then if we looked at those that we, through this method that our staff person utilized, his best estimate was that about 345,000 acres of that million, or 100,000 acres of that 500,000, are areas where we don't have a buffer. We have cultivation of some sort adjacent to that part of that stream or water body. So that's you wanted to get some sense of the whole story, and this is our best attempt to do that without having to send people out for many years to measure these things.
That is actually a good perspective for us to have. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jashke, when there's the redetermination of benefits or an improvement where the 16 and a half foot buffer is required, are you able to overlay the funds that you're talking about here with the permanent easement, either clean water or outdoor heritage funds? Can you add on, can you be additive with the landowner? And if so, have there been landowners who have broadened that buffer out to the 50 foot beyond the 16 and a half that was required?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, we have, you know, examples of where these buffers have been established adjacent to a public ditch system where there was already a 16 and a half foot requirement in place. We try to manage the whole thing as a unit, but in the case of a 16 and a half foot strip, that also is necessary for access for maintenance and things like that. So we typically, you know, either don't include it, or if we do include it, we don't pay them for it because it's a part of the ditch system, really, and they need to be able to tread on that in a way that's different than the conservation lands that are adjacent to it.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Jashke, on the redetermination of benefits, there's, my understanding, there's some counties, maybe some watershed districts, but where the drainage authority, the county auditor, make a decision to say we're going to go through and redetermine the benefits on all the public drainage systems in the county. Has that occurred, or how many times has that occurred where a local county official is able to exercise their discretion and are able to implement a complete countywide redetermination?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, a redetermination of benefits really, let me just point out two things. One, there's two trigger mechanisms. One is a petition is brought forth to do that. Or secondly, as Representative Hansen described, the ditch authority, the county board or the water district as a trustee of the ditch system to do it on their own initiative. The redetermination of benefits simply is a reapportionment of the costs and benefits of maintaining the ditch because it's already constructed. And so there are several counties in the last few years that have taken on the systematic redetermination of benefits. I know that Maurer County has done it. I know Freeborn has done it. I believe Martin County is doing it. These are just in my head. I know we have a more complete list, and I could ask our chief engineer, Al Kane, to come up with that list, if that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jasky, does every square foot of buffer installed have a water quality impact?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I suppose not. I'm thinking now of an example of where if a surface tile intake, for example, were to be placed, off the ditch system somewhere and it would have been outletted into the ditch system, that it would have been bypassed by the buffer, if one was there, would have been bypassed by the subsurface pipe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has any effort been made to determine what percentage of the buffers being installed actually do have a water quality impact?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, not that specifically. If you hold on a moment, we do have an analysis or the study that was done by USGS that looked at the benefits of the water quality practice that buffers are accomplishing. But as I said at the very beginning, it's very, very site specific because every site has its own design and it's needed. Some places a buffer is not going to be effective, some places it can be effective. And so in other cases, other practices, like was described earlier, the subsurface, bioreactor works much better. And so we got to fit the solution to the problem.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I couldn't agree more. I think we have the tools to sophisticatedly target these practices and to just look at a ditch and say it should have a 50-foot buffer because that will help water quality is really only part of the story. We need to identify the areas along those ditches that actually will benefit from buffers, and there may be areas where we need a wider buffer, and there may be areas where we really don't need a buffer at all. We like to look at pictures and see these nice green strips along the side and think that by putting those green strips we're having a grand impact on water quality, when in reality, by targeting our efforts on buffering, we could have a much more impact on water quality.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I would agree, and I think, in terms of wanting to make sure we're being cost-effective with all of our projects, we don't get to do all these things. We have to make sure we're being most effective with our funds, and that's one way to do it, is to make sure we're only using the areas and enrolling the land that is going to contribute to that benefit.
Representative Torkelson, the Pollution Control Agency has become more sophisticated in how it's doing TMDLs and it by specific areas. And you have reminded me that we should probably ask them to show us what they are doing, and we will do that because it gets to more of the specificity that you're talking about and how you apply it. So it's, thank you for reminding me. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Torkelson and Mr. Jasky bring up a good point. Part of it also depends on the buffer being maintained, what the vegetative cover is. Some buffers are in legumes, some are in native grasses, depending on the location, whether the contract is for 10 years or 15 years or is perpetual. Because the public can pay for establishment of a buffer, but if it's not maintained, or if it goes to thistles or hemp. You know, it's going to be, or nettles, it's going to be not as effective. And there is quite a bit of, I think the Journal of Environmental Conservation had a whole book on this last summer looking at some of the data. So this gets back to some of the earlier questions of when we target, we have the installation, but we also have to look at the maintenance and making sure that they're maintained and that there isn't that creep that goes on, or if we've got a maintenance issue that's going on, the tire traffic, having the ruts go through. So we've got a lot of experience in this, and I think at the local districts, they do know that, and they can also go out and check and make sure that the contracts are being maintained so that that public investment is there. And maybe it's not providing the water quality benefit 24/7, 365, but it might be providing wildlife habitat benefit or just basic wind erosion during the winter when maybe having a black snow if it's not there. So I think there is good work being done at the local level, and folks know what fits in their area. I think the bottom line, and I think what I heard earlier, is that the demand is really high for this program. There are landowners who want it, and so we need to make sure the science and technical assistance is there to make up for them to implement it. Mm-hmm. And I'll just ask again, Mr. Jaschke, is the demand high? I mean, do you have more people who want to do this than the money available?
Madam Chair, Representative Manson, yes, that's the case. We limited any single county to $1 million of enrollment because the first time we did this, two counties, Renville County and Redwood County, actually took all the money before anybody else had a shot because there were that many people they had ready to sign up. And so we then go back and once the first, you know, wave has been accomplished, then, you know, we look at what's, you know, we can dole it out in smaller increments. And so otherwise, you know, it's making sure it gets, there's a lot of demand, and the targets are very well known. I mean, the local practitioners, the local experts know where these sites are that can benefit from a buffer or another practice. And so, yes, that is the case. I just want to continue, Madam Chair, if there's no more questions.
I am debating here. Let me just ask if anyone in the audience would like to testify this morning who can't come tonight. I don't see any, so let's continue.
Well, and again, I just want to continue on this analysis, and then I'll be done with this part of it. We then did this same attempt at the analysis using just the public waters, which are the larger streams and rivers that have, you know, identified on a map the DNR has created, you know, beginning some, you know, 30 or 40 years ago now. This would not include the ditches any longer. So this just gives you some sense of looking at those numbers, what the total amount of, this is in acres now, not linear feet, or we just took the 50-foot width and multiplied it by the length and came up with an acre estimate, because that's typically what is used to estimate the cost of these things. We also, fortunately, had one area of the Cannon River watershed where the Cannon River Watershed Partnership had actually taken on the effort to do a more intensive photo interpretation with some on-site calibration of that work. And so we tried to look at their work, which is reflected in this bar chart with the green bars. And when they looked at it actually on the ground, they found that the numbers weren't as challenging as we did with this statewide analysis. So that's a good thing, that, you know, when you get closer to the sites, you actually find that more of these sites had buffers than it would be apparent on the statewide data layer. You know, over time we'll get better data layers, but, you know, again, as was said earlier, finding the actual sites and getting something on the ground with the practice that's needed is the most important thing. Madam Chair, I'll just shift gears a little bit here to talk about outcomes. You know, we talked about, you know, you asked about that earlier, and Representative Falk asked about the estimation versus the actual. All of our estimators that we use are calibrated with some research behind them. We use the University of Minnesota and some others that work on these estimators. We can't do actual measurements at every site. I mean, we would be spending way more money than anyone would ever dream of to do that. So we have to use good science and then extrapolate it to other similar locations to get the best way to come up with the approximate benefits of these projects. This study was done by the university. I'm sorry, by the U.S. Geological Survey, along with some help from one of our staff, and they looked at three watersheds, smaller watersheds, in the Minnesota River Basin, to look at the benefits of, you know, land retirement or buffers, really, in the areas adjacent to these streams. And I'm not going to give you the whole study. They could come and do that for you at some point. We've got a summary of it in your packet, and I'll highlight a few of the aspects of it here. These are the three sub-watersheds that they looked at, and these are just, you know, again, one picture to show one little part of one of these streams. And so even though they are, you know, they're perhaps representative of these watersheds, each of these three watersheds had a different level of riparian buffer installation. So they were able to look at the one in Nicola County had the least, and then working your way upstream towards more buffers. And so they looked at these three watersheds and determined that they were very similar in terms of their land use or topography and so forth. And they were doing basically a paired watershed study with these three sub-watersheds, with the goal of trying to determine the benefits of riparian buffers. You know, where should they be, and what do they accomplish in terms of water quality? And I'm boiling this down a great deal, and the scientists that put this together would probably want to spend much more time giving you the details, but I'll boil it down this way. They measured two things, and more than two things. They measured chemistry and biology. They used, in the case of chemistry, you know, the one of the things that they looked at was nitrogen, you know, moving, you know, from the landscape into the water. In essence, the study said, and it came out actually the same for the biology as well, and they used this index of biological integrity, which is basically looking at these, the lower level food chain aspects of what's going on in the stream, all the way up to fish. They looked at fish, but all the way down to the macroinvertebrates and other things. And so, you know, the biology is a longer term, you know, more, you know, sort of broad-based assessment. You know, the nitrogen is a chemical component that comes and goes rather quickly. So you're looking at a short-term aspect and a long-term aspect of water quality. And in both cases, the conclusion was that riparian buffers of about 50 feet right next to the stream, where they are intercepting sheet flow and other runoff, are one of the best ways to very quickly, in a small watershed like this, make noticeable improvements. These buffers have been in place for no longer than 10 years in the case of the watershed that had the most buffers in it, and they had seen these increases both in the biology and the chemistry basically attributable to this one practice. Now there, you know, I'm sure other practices that are needed in other parts of the watershed. They also said that if you had to pick where to put these buffers, because we are always limited in resources, that putting them in the headwaters of these watersheds has more benefit than putting them lower in the watershed. That's, you know, it's a generalization, but I still think it has value for our decision making, because you treat the water before it accumulates into a downstream hydrograph. So that's the conclusion. And again, the summary of the report is in your packet with the authors that were part of it. You know, this is our way of, you know, saying there are outcomes from this practice without having to measure every single one of these sites, because we just can't afford to do that. We have to use something that's more able to be exported or extrapolated from a few sites to many.
I appreciate this study and your charts. Unfortunately, they're really small in our packet right now, and they're hard for take home, but we can resolve that. Representative Kahn, did you have a question?
It was just a comment, actually, on one of the ways to be able to get more data on it is that programs that might involve local school districts and kids in science classes and putting out a plan for more rigorous data taking that would both involve children in environmental protection, would also help teach science and technology, and would possibly economically, you know, get us the things that we're asking for, like more data on these issues. I also wanted to make a comment. It's very exciting to start talking about hemp is riparian borders, and maybe we'll also look at hemp brick construction for walls and all sorts of things. So perhaps we'll move forward on that and encourage the federal government to move forward on it.
That, of course, may be, we are about ready to recess, it may be the right place to do that. Did you want to make any?
Madam Chair, just one last comment about this, and this is probably a good place to come back, but I wanted to just mention that this study was funded by the LCCMR, and you know, very useful to have this one time so we don't repeat it over and over. And I, you know, to the Representative Kahn's comment, I mean, these buffer areas, where it makes sense, can be harvested, you know, on occasion to provide some benefit for eating or grazing or energy production someday if it comes to that, too. So there are some ancillary benefits beyond water quality and habitat that are derived from these sites.
Okay, Representative Polk has a question.
No, just a housekeeping thing. If I could move approval of the minutes from the January 30th meeting, I would make that motion.
Paul moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. One of the things that I think we need for this committee is you have a list of counties and approximately how much has been buffered on the public waters and how much hasn't. And if you could bring that for tonight, I think that would be helpful.
I'm sure we can do that.
Thank you. With that, members, we are in recess until 6:15. I do need to announce the zoo cannot bring animals tonight. There seems to be some glitch about which I don't know between the zoo and how they can bring animals into a building, and I don't know what the glitch is at all. It's just the first I found out about it. But it will be resolved before zoo day, I understand. So we will be back here at 6:15.
Thank you.